We welcome you to join us on the porch. Today's show is made possible by VRC Limited. Grab a coffee or a cool lemonade and join our host, Randy Voller, for a slice of life from the perspective of one of Chatham County's most actively engaged community leaders, former mayor, real estate developer, musician, and all-around great guy. Now, here's Randy.
And welcome back to On the Porch with your host, Randy Voller. I've been so lucky that Mark Shelburne's decided to stay on the porch. And so we did a previous episode about housing policy and affordable housing, and we're going to do another one today. Mark is a housing policy consultant with Novo Gradac, and his work includes consulting with state agencies, local governments, and developers on affordable housing. He has multiple degrees here from UNC Chapel Hill in law, planning, and public policy. So, Mark, thanks for coming back on the porch.
Certainly.
So, Mark, first question I have is that you work at this company, and when I contacted you, Novo Gradac, that's a mouthful. What is that firm?
Well, and that's actually the last name of the founder and managing partner, Michael Novo Gradac. He started an accounting firm in 1989 in San Francisco to do, at the time, focus primarily on the low-income housing tax credit. And since then, it's grown dramatically to a firm of 800 or so employees. I'm not sure what the latest number is. That's primarily accountants, but it also does market studies and appraisals. And then there's a few people like me that do policy work.
So it says you do consulting with state agencies. What type of consulting do you do?
I primarily help the equivalent to the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency in other states with drafting and implementing their rules and answering questions about how to run their programs.
Which local governments have contacted you?
Well, I did some work for the city of Charlotte last year on their trust fund. And otherwise, I don't know that I've had any actual other clients in North Carolina locally. I've had some local governments in other states that I've worked with.
It would seem like that the Council of Governments would want to bring you in.
Well, I did speak last week, I believe it was, at the Land of Sky COG.
And out in the western part of our state.
Indeed. They had a great event, Western NC Housing Forum, and they asked me to speak there.
All right. So what's going on with housing in the Land of Sky?
Well, it's the same difficulties that we have in Chapel Hill, except their land is a lot less buildable for the most part.
Yes. It's mountainous, and you can't really build with certain inclines.
Exactly.
So I got a question for you. I started off working on the Chatham County Affordable Housing Task Force even before I got into local politics. I was recruited because I was in the business in housing and developing building. And we formed the task force. I sat on it. And we brought in experts, and we thought about the problem and what to do. And then we had a report done by the Wooten Company that showed in 2009 that we needed 1,700 units, so we had a scarcity. And then nothing happened. And it's been my experience in observing and being part of policy, you know, from on a local level or regional level, is everyone knows what the problem is, but no one seems to have the willpower to actually address it. And they would rather fund or appoint another study commission. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. That happens all the time. And it goes back to what we discussed in the previous episode of the local governments being unable to make fundamental changes due to the interests of their most vocal constituents.
And unfortunately, the most vocal constituents are not always representative of the community at large.
Indeed.
So I've noticed also in your career, you've revised over 45 qualified allocation plans across 18 states. What's an allocation plan?
So those are the rules for the program called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, and that's the federal government's really last – it's the only consequential affordable rental production program that we still have in the country. Now, obviously, Section 8 and public housing still exist, and they do They're very important and they serve a lot of people, but they're not producing new housing. The low-income housing tax credit is what generates new units and rehabilitates existing units.
And that came out of the Tax Reform Act of 1986.
Indeed.
And I often tell people that it was one of the most successful programs that came out of the act. I think in North Carolina, you worked at the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency, and they've done almost 300,000 affordable homes and close to $30 billion of allocation.
Well, that's over their entire portfolio. That wouldn't just be the housing credit.
Oh, that would be the whole portfolio.
Right, because they do a lot of single family activity as well.
So explain to folks, just the layperson, what is this tax credit program?
So what it's a truly remarkable pay for success model is the way it ultimately works. So when a state determines that a property is eligible for the credit, it generates this, again, tax credit. And so corporations invest equity so as to benefit, so as to reduce their tax liability. So for every dollar that they'll reduce their tax liability, they'll invest, say, 90 cents. And that investment of equity means that the property has to borrow less from a bank. And so as a result of the fact they have much less debt, they have much less debt service, which allows the units to have affordable rents.
This seems like a much more elegant solution and policy for dealing with corporate taxation than just slashing tax rates.
Indeed. Absolutely. It works really well.
Because it's the same concept. Essentially, you're providing a pathway for lowering a tax liability or tax burden, but you're doing it with the method to getting a public good.
Right. Exactly. Yep. And there are other tax credits along those lines, in like for historic and for various energy efficiency type products.
So don't they also have a tax-exempt bond that's a little bit lower in the rate that also goes with? How does that work?
Indeed. So that is a distinct program, the tax-exempt bonds. It's called private activity bonds. And that allows whoever receives the interest from those bonds to not have to pay taxes on them. And if the property that has those bonds does a certain kind of affordable housing, then it also gets to generate a tax credit.
Have we had any of those projects in North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. There's less of them because they have less subsidy and greater transactional costs. And so they're harder for make the numbers work. But we've done a lot of them.
Wouldn't there be a method if you had a nonprofit working with the local government and private developer to do those or to float the bonds through the municipality or county?
Well, look, the first part of what you said definitely happens. And but in terms of the being able to issue the bonds, you have to go through the state to get the approval.
You have to go through the state. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not like a general obligation bond. There's a limited supply of them.
Who are the buyers of these bonds?
Well, that's a great question. There's a limit to my expertise on that, but ultimately it's Wall Street.
Ultimately, they're marketed through Wall Street.
Right.
So those are two of the programs that you administered. What was another program at the Housing Finance Agency you did?
I'd say the next main one is the Home Investment Partnership Program.
The Home Investment Partnership Program. We'll pick up with that after the break. This is On the Porch with Mark Shelburne, a housing policy consultant. Join us after the break.
You're listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller, made possible by VRC Limited. Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
Welcome back. We're here with Mark Shelburne, a housing policy consultant. So, Mark, before we went to the break, we were talking about a couple of items that were connected to the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. Talk to us about how these tax credit programs help folks who are disabled obtain affordable living.
So that's really one of the main, I would say, one of the top success stories of the Housing Finance Agency in a long time, certainly of which I had a part. It was started back in 2002. The agency began working with the State Department of Health and Human Services to effectively require every tax credit project that got an award to set aside 10% of its units for persons with disabilities. And those units would come to the property through a network of referrals coordinated by the State Department of Health and Human Services. And the owner's responsibility was really just to make certain the units were available. And then the state also would step in and provide, to the extent it was necessary, operating subsidy to make the units affordable for the people that are to live there.
And you've seen this as being a very successful way of addressing the scarcity of housing for folks who are disabled.
Well, and absolutely, and it's not just me. The whole model for this was the inspiration for Department of Health of Housing and Urban Development to change what had been a different way of creating housing for people with disabilities into this same approach. It was called 811. And so it used to be they'd build standalone properties. Mm-hmm. But because of the example set by this program here in North Carolina, Congress said, well, we can change this to make it to where it is instead of building standalone properties, we're going to provide support for units for folks that get referred to the properties. And then they just live in the community just like everyone else.
So what made you actually get into this field? I mean, I love talking to you about this because to me it's an incredibly interesting policy conversation. But what made you get into this, and what made you get a degree in law and planning and public policy and dedicate your life to doing this?
Well, I can hardly remember why I chose the degrees I did. It was so long ago. But
you're a Gen Xer like me.
Well, born in 71. So
you're a couple years younger than me, but a Gen Xer. So, why you can't remember why
exactly
you decided to do it.
But I do remember why I got into the field. I started off you probably heard the term dirt lawyer, did strip malls and cell towers for a commercial real estate firm. And that was a good place to start, but I knew it wasn't going to be my future. And so when a friend of mine said they were hiring for an in-house counsel with a nonprofit that did affordable housing, I was all in, and I've never looked back.
And you just kept going.
Exactly.
So when you see what's happening now in our area in Chapel Hill, what are your thoughts about, you know, the density being done now? You see a lot of apartments going up. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I mean, it just depends on how you define a lot. It's a lot relative to what maybe has been done.
I guess you could say when there were zero and you're one,
right,
you've gone up 100%.
Exactly, yes, indeed. But it's not a lot compared to the demand. And that's something that I don't think people fully appreciate is, you know, they look at those apartments getting built and they think, how could that be necessary? Well, that's actually not just someone taking a flyer. That is something the firms like mine do. We analyze the market. We see, is there going to be a demand for this building when it gets built? Because no surprise, the people that are funding it, whether it's equity, debt, they want to know that this property is going to get filled up after it gets built.
Do you see a possibility? I've read a couple articles about this. I'm going to ask you, where there's a lot of commercial office supply, especially in like Chicago, for instance, that folks are talking about converting it into housing.
Indeed. That is a great hope out there. And I think it would be excellent to occur. And I'm not an expert on design and construction. I can barely hammer a nail. But as I understand it, the way the office buildings are designed makes it often cost prohibitive to convert them to residential. It has to do with the way the floor plans are laid out, the kind of plumbing that goes into mm-hmm. them, those sorts of considerations. So by the time you converted them to be suitable for residential, you may as well have torn the building down to start over again.
Now, that's unfortunate. So what are your thoughts about things that we see out here in the marketplace, such as accessible dwelling units or ADUs?
Well, ADUs, I used to be a real skeptic of them. I thought that the folks that were really pushing for them just maybe were anticipating a family member moving in and wanted them to live in the backyard instead of the main house. But the where they have really taken hold, they've actually made a big difference. And oddly enough, for all of its NIMBY characteristics, one of the few bright spots in Los Angeles has been allowing ADUs. And there's been a tremendous reaction to that. Folks have built hundreds, maybe even thousands of them. And so they can be a really excellent approach.
We personally have an ADU with a unit above the garage that's been filled ever since we built it. And it started off with actually someone who was disabled, who needed it. What do you think of the missing middle when they talk about that? First, define what that is, and then let us know what you think about it.
Well, I don't know that it necessarily has any one definition. It's kind of like when people say workforce housing, as if that's a term that's real, and it's not.
Well, you know why they say that. They don't want to say affordable.
Exactly. Indeed. It's straight up marketing. So if folks were to take nothing from these episodes that there is no such thing as workforce housing, then that'd be great. But missing middle is a little better understood. And I don't know that I want to try to characterize it necessarily. But as I understand it, most folks mean that it's townhouses, maybe a fourplex, those sorts of
structures. I tried to explain it, and I want to get your reaction, to people in my business and others the other day, and said, you know, you've got these large, let's say, mansions, McMansions at one side, and you're coming out of the country and you see kind of the range of housing kind of from a longitudinal look. And what we're missing as we get toward, you know, full-fledged skyscraper apartment complexes are the triplexes and quadruplexes and duplexes that used to exist in our city and town environments that are no longer there. You have like detached single-family townhouses, condos, and then you have, you know, super dense housing here in mixed use, but you don't have this other product. It's just gone. And because I said it has nothing to do with housing for – they were thinking like housing for workforce housing. And I said that's not what it means. It's a product type.
Right. But because of its nature, it's almost always going to be more affordable than what would be a comparable single-family home.
Exactly, because it's attached, so it's cheaper to build.
Right.
And it's going to – the rents or owning it will be less expensive.
Indeed.
So I'm curious that you pointed out this issue about workforce, because I'll ask you, I used to try to call it affordable living because I thought that we needed a holistic approach, that it also had to do with transportation and utilities as opposed to just saying housing. What are your thoughts on that? Well, we'll get to that right after the break with Mark Shelburne. Tune in after the break.
You're listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller, made possible by VRC Limited. Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
Welcome back on the porch with Mark Shelburne, who's a housing policy consultant. Mark, I was just before we got to the break, I was asking what you thought about the idea of affordable living in trying to bring in a more holistic approach to addressing this issue with including utilities and access to transportation, et cetera. Were you considering that as a policy consultant?
Well, that is a fundamental component of what we talked about at the beginning of the program, the qualified allocation plan, the rules for distributing where the low-income housing tax credit properties get built. That the QAP takes into account those sorts of considerations. You have to be within a certain distance of grocery stores. You get bonus points for having transit nearby. And the property has to be built to a certain green standard. So it does take those into account.
Are you familiar with the bill that they started, I think, in the Senate this past session that went nowhere? It was a workforce housing bill that had co-sponsors on it from both sides. And the idea was to provide essentially density bonuses to landowners or developers for providing housing that would address 80% of median and below. And in doing so would – knock down some of the regulatory impediments that existed, whether the housing – the one of the limits in the bill was you had to have 10 acres at least, and whether you were in the country or in the city. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this bill.
I remember when it came out. I don't remember much about it, the specifics, but it struck me as a very tiny step in the right direction.
Well, it seems to me that they probably should look at that concept you mentioned to me about – just changing it to R.
Yep.
And that would address it right there without actually trying to shape the market.
And state preemption sounds crazy here in North Carolina. And to some folks, it sounds bad because of the way it's been used in certain other contexts. But it happens around the country. California, again, they, for all their problems, they do have extensive forms of state preemption of local zoning. And in certain ways, it's been really successful.
Do you think there's a possibility that people raise environmental issues merely to scare people into not approving projects?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. And I say this as someone, I think we both agree we want clean water, we want a clean environment, we want it to be, you know, protect our rivers. But sometimes it occurs to me that people raise these issues just for the idea to scare people to vote no.
Well, exactly. And so if you don't build the dense housing because it needed the zoning approval, then those people are still coming to that community. So what they're going to go is out on the outskirts of town where it's easier to get the zoning into different kinds of housing. So every apartment complex, every dense town condo building that gets denied is a sprawl that's built somewhere else.
So now you're actually pointing a finger at an issue that you raised earlier, that density is the friend of dealing with climate change.
Right.
Because you're just saying that these houses or units are going to be sought elsewhere. It could be 50 to 60 miles away.
Right.
And people are driving in to the job.
Indeed. Absolutely.
And that's creating a lot of vehicle miles traveled.
Indeed.
Well, if you could wave your magic wand and someone made you the czar of this in North Carolina, what would you simply do?
Well, the R zoning and a tremendous increase in appropriations for affordable housing.
Well, here you have it. From the expert Mark Shelburne, we would just have a simpler R zoning and we would put more money into the allocations of the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. Thank you for being on the porch.
Thank you.
And we hope to have you as a guest again. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to On the Porch with Randy Voller on 97.9 The Hill. Catch episodes on demand at chapelboro.com/onTheporch.